Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, cluster bombs are one step closer to becoming a nightmare of the past. Pope Benedict expresses his satisfaction with the adoption of the International Convention banning the deadly munitions and bridging the gap between the deaf and those who can hear. If you're listening to this program, you're already one step in the right direction. They come in all sorts of bright colors and shapes. Children find them irresistible. But these small objects are no toy. They explode when you pick them up or accidentally step on one, ripping apart face and limb, blinding eyes, and deafening ears. The horrific symbol of man's inhumanity to man, cluster bombs litter the landscapes of war zones across the globe and remain silent snares for decades to come. But as of August 1, 2010, cluster bombs are one step closer to becoming the nightmare of the past. The convention banning cluster munitions took effect on that date, becoming binding international law. Well, 108 governments have signed the convention so far, but only 38 of them have ratified it. So I asked Tom Nash, coordinator of the international civil society campaign, the Cluster Munition Coalition, is it realistic, then, to think that anyone is going to take the convention seriously?
Sure. If you think about the speed at which this process has gone, it's actually very unusual and quite remarkable. The negotiating period was only 18 months. Beginning of 2007 to the middle of 2008. Since it opened for signature in December 2008, we've had 108 signatures, and to have within 2 years of it opening for signature, 38 countries ratifying is extremely fast-paced if you compare it to other international treaties like the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Or other such treaties. So we think this swift ratification really does underscore what others have talked about. The Secretary General of the UN talked about the collective revulsion of the international community towards these weapons, and we think this swift ratification really underscores that commitment from the world to prohibit this weapon.
What about the countries that have failed so far to sign up to the convention? They're some of the most conspicuous countries that have failed to do so.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have focused around entry into force on the countries that haven't signed, like the US, Russia, and China. And I suppose that's understandable. But for us, that's missing the point slightly. For us, what's most important is to solve the problem on the ground, to clear land contaminated by cluster munitions, to assist victims of cluster munitions, and to prevent further use in the future. So we are confident that we've got a good mix of countries to allow us to do that. We've got the majority of the countries affected, including Laos and Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan. They're on board. We've got many of the biggest donors to mine clearance, cluster bomb clearance, victim assistance around the world. But beyond that, we also think that the treaty's going to force countries to modify their behavior, whether they sign the treaty or not. The best example of this is the Landmines Treaty, where 10 years after that was entered into force, many countries haven't signed it. For example, the U.S., Russia, and China haven't signed that, but the U.S. has not used, produced, or transferred anti-personnel landmines since that treaty was signed. So we think the same phenomenon can be observed, will be observed, with cluster munitions, now that the weapon has been thoroughly stigmatized after most of the world has banned it.
Well, in fact, we saw that Israel used cluster munitions in its war on Lebanon in 2006. Also, the U.S.-led coalition employed these munitions, I believe, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obviously, the effects of these munitions are going to be around for years to come. What makes these cluster munitions such a heinous weapon?
Yeah, well, cluster munitions are probably one of the worst conventional weapons that exists today. There's two problems, two reasons why they kill too many civilians. First of all, they cover very, very wide areas. They open, it's basically a bomb that opens up in midair after being fired from artillery or rocket or dropped from an aircraft bomb. It opens up over an area and it scatters out hundreds or thousands of these smaller bomblets. And because of that wide area effect, it means when they're used in populated areas, which they very often have been, you're pretty much guaranteed to kill anyone in that area, whether they're civilian or military. But the second problem is that many of these little bombs that come out of the bigger bombs, they don't explode when they hit the ground. And so they lie around unexploded, ready to kill or injure anyone who steps on them or picks them up. And that effect we're seeing in countries like Laos, where even 35 years after the conflict ended, people are still being killed and injured on a regular basis. So it's horrific to imagine that a weapon is killing more people after the conflict than during the conflict.
Desidero esprimere vivo compiacimento per l'entrata in vigore proprio oggi della Convenzione sul bando delle munizioni a grappolo che provocano danni inaccettabili ai civili.
Speaking on the day the treaty came into force on August 1st, Pope Benedict praised the international community for what he called its wisdom, foresight, and capability in implementing what he called a significant achievement in the pursuit of disarmament and international humanitarian rights. He especially remembered the many victims of cluster bombs, whom he said have suffered and continue to suffer serious physical and psychological harm or even death from these insidious weapons, whose long-term presence, he said, on the ground often prevents entire communities from resuming their daily activities. He urged all nations to adhere to the convention and to work more vigorously for disarmament.
E per la realizzazione del bene comune di tutte le persone e di tutti i popoli.
Though most people probably don't know it, the Holy See has played an important role in the adoption of this convention ever since a global ban on cluster munitions was first conceived. So how important is it that the Pope and the Holy See be heard on these issues?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, most people wouldn't know that the Holy See has played a role. I think many people don't really actually even know that the Holy See plays a role in diplomacy. But it certainly is true that for us, as the civil society campaign that led the push, we recognize very strongly that some of the diplomats from the Holy See in Geneva and at the UN were really instrumental in sort of bridging the gaps between different positions that different countries took and having a really positive moral influence, I think, on the process. So for us, it's been a very positive interaction. And I think, you know, the religious leaders around the world from a range of faiths have really provided a kind of moral impetus to the broader global campaign. And that's been, I think, quite an important aspect of the broader civil society outreach to all countries to get them to sign. I think that outreach is going to be important in the years to come as we try to get more countries on board the ban and try to make sure that all governments comply with their obligations to clear up the land, assist the victims, and destroy their stockpiles.
Okay, if you had a wish list of things for the future besides the ones you just mentioned, what would it be?
Well, I think the first thing is to make sure that we get all of the countries that are affected by cluster bombs to sign this convention, to join as soon as possible. I mentioned some in particular, Vietnam, Cambodia, Serbia, Tajikistan, these countries are affected by cluster bombs. They have no reason not to sign. They stand to gain a lot from signing. And I think for us, it's extremely important that those countries come on board as soon as possible so that we can establish a real forum that will be the frame of reference for solving the cluster bomb problem. And that's what this treaty should be.
I'd just like to mention the United States' policy regarding the cluster munitions. The Pentagon announced that by the end of 2018, the U.S. will no longer use cluster munitions that have a failure rate, they say, of more than 1%. In essence, they're banning all but a tiny fraction of the existing arsenal that the U.S. has. What are you hoping to see from the United States at this point?
Well, I mean, the United States should join the ban on cluster bombs. The United States should join the ban on landmines. But the United States is missing from a number of international treaties, and that is, in the view of many people in civil society, I think very disappointing. But what's probably most important is that the U.S. stops producing these weapons, stops using these weapons, and stop selling these weapons. The U.S. has already made a commitment to no longer transfer cluster munitions, or the vast majority of their cluster munitions. So that's a positive step, and I think in line with the international direction on this issue, which is to reject the weapon completely. But I think what we want to see from the U.S. is a commitment to, if these weapons that they're saying they're going to remove by 2018, if they're unacceptable in 2018, then they're unacceptable now. So the U.S. needs to accelerate that policy, and it needs to get in line with the vast majority of its allies. 22 out of 28 NATO countries have banned the weapon. It's going to be very difficult for them to be deciding to use this weapon in joint military operations now, given the moral pressure. Countries that partner with the U.S. in military operations now have a legal obligation under the cluster bomb treaty to discourage and try to prevent the U.S. from using cluster munitions. And we're going to be following that very closely from civil society. So I think what we want to see is the U.S. Really accepting that as a world leader, it has a responsibility to promote the protection of civilians and to promote international humanitarian law.
Tom Nash is coordinator of the international civil society campaign, the Cluster Munition Coalition. You've probably seen them before, animatedly gesticulating with their hands and mouthing words, but emitting few sounds. Theirs is the silent world of deafness, a secret and mysterious world to most of us who can hear. They look and act like everybody else, except when they don't turn around when you call out their name. So, sometimes deaf people are looked upon as being strange, different, not quite normal.
I have to admit that I struggle with it, and I thank God for the opportunity to just pray some of those frustrations away.
No, Nicole Clark isn't deaf. She can hear just like those of you listening to this program. She's frustrated, though, because she sees how the deaf, or people seen as being different, are often treated, how they can be stigmatized, ostracized, and sometimes ridiculed. Nicole, the official sign translator for the Archdiocese of Sydney, Australia, has dedicated her life to being a bridge between the deaf and those who can hear.
I think God very specifically gave me the ability to hear, because I'm probably not patient enough to be a deaf person, because I see the exclusion and the oppression, and I find it quite overwhelming. And I have learnt so much from a deaf person's ability to be patient and to just live with the exclusion. But I think it's a responsibility of all of those who have encountered both parts of living, the part of the world that can hear and the part of the world that can't. It's our responsibility to enlighten. I often say you can't criticise someone for being ignorant, but after they're no longer ignorant, arrogance is certainly a challenge.
Arrogance out of ignorance is a challenge, one that is likely to grow unless people start getting to know their deaf neighbor, colleague, or classmate. The World Health Organization estimates that some 280 million people worldwide have moderate to profound hearing loss in both ears. And the numbers are growing, thanks to longer life expectancies and a growing global population. Speaking of the difficulties deaf people face, Pope Benedict said there's a lingering culture today of real prejudice and discrimination against them. These are deplorable and unjustifiable attitudes, he said, because they are contrary to respect for the dignity of the non-hearing person and his or her full social integration. Well, Mara Buckley from Ireland is one of the some 1.3 million Catholic faithful who are deaf. Through her translator, Veronica, she told me of some of the challenges she and other deaf people face in society today. Be patient during the pauses. That's Mara speaking to us through sign language.
The challenges are access, lack of access to information, access to the general communication in the church, in public places, and without interpreters we are lost.
How do you think that the Catholic Church can improve its ministry to deaf people?
Learn about deaf people, get information about deaf people, have deaf awareness, understand their language, culture, and so on. Make them feel as if they're not very different, that they're just like us. The only thing they cannot do is hear. They're like hearing people, and when they have access to communication, you do not see the difference. And include them. Make deaf people feel that they are one of them. Include them.
In an effort to include deaf people and the hearing impaired in ever new ways, the Vatican recently held an international conference on ministry to the deaf called EFFATA, a command to open up or open one's ears to God and to possibilities. Well, Liverpool's Archbishop Patrick Kelly was one of the organizers of the event. He's also president of the International Catholic Foundation for the Service of Deaf Persons.
One of the gifts of St. Paul was to describe us as a body. And he said, in this body, every single member is indispensable. And the point of the image was, curiously, not primarily our unity, but our diversity. And the eye can't say to the ear, I don't need you. The head can't say to the feet, I don't need you. And St. Paul even said, the weakest members are indispensable. Now, we are only a healthy society when that is the reality. For example, a restaurant. We like mood music and dark colours, but that means deaf people can't communicate in a restaurant. My sister has hearing loss. And she says, when she goes to any place where there's background music, which is almost everywhere, she said, my head is spinning, because I then cannot hear what anybody's saying. And even in church, one of the examples I give when we're designing a church, make sure the light is evenly spread so that you don't cast shadows across faces, because the faces and the lips must be seen. So we must always be learning.
I was shocked to learn that 80% of deaf or hearing impaired people live in low and middle income countries. Pope Benedict lays the blame on the lack of appropriate policies and legislation, and on the difficulty in accessing primary health care. Deafness, in fact, is often a consequence of illnesses that are easily curable. Sometimes it's simply a question of nutrition. But Archbishop Kelly suspects that the high incidence of deafness in developing nations reflects a dark side of wealthy countries.
There's one very sad reason. There can be screening, and babies in the womb who are found to run the risk of being deaf in many richer countries will be aborted. I know a lady who was told she was expecting twins who would be deaf, and she was asked to go and see a specialist, and she thought to help her to bring them up and educate them, and found the specialist was to enable her to end the pregnancy. And she, being a nurse and a strong lady, said, "May I repeat, I'm expecting babies, and expecting means I'm waiting for." The irony is, she said, when I gave birth to my two sons, they were not deaf, in fact. In fact, they became leading choristers of a cathedral choir. But you can see the message that if you're not perfect, then our society said, well, do we really need you? That may be one of the factors.
What can the Universal Church do, for example, in areas where there's a lack of funding, in Africa, in the Middle East? How can the church help to see a continuing education for deaf people, for deaf children particularly, so they can be inserted as full members of the church community?
I think, first of all, lessons from history. What now has been accomplished, for example, in the United States or in my own country, it began in very small ways. It began with somehow people who, were their hearts, the great phrase, "Eftheta," were opened to this particular group of people, because somebody once put it this way: you can see the white stick of the blind person, you can see the wheelchair, you cannot see the deafness, so it tends to be forgotten. I think, therefore, if people are beginning, let them not lose heart. But the second thing, the whole question of funding is a massively complex issue on all sorts of levels across the world and in the church today. But I do believe one absolutely central issue of the church's priority is where there is an opportunity to open up hearts and minds to the gospel, while we do things like building wells because there's no water and all these things, yes, fine, but we're sent to bring the good news, and therefore the emphasis on authentic catechesis, schooling, for me is absolutely central.
You mentioned earlier this church should be thinking about even just the lighting in a church, how to get the deaf population involved.
That's right.
So what else can the church do to allow these people to be more a part of the congregation?
One thing which some parishes in Liverpool, where I serve as Archbishop, just one or two, have now taught the congregation to use sign language. So when deaf people come, the whole congregation knows how to do the responses in sign language.
You're kidding. And, no, that's quite amazing.
And it is wonderful to see. And some of the schools now, they teach all children authentic sign language. One of the problems is there is around this thing called Makaton, which is a pseudo sign language. It's not, quite rightly, let's just say, American sign language is as different, let's just the example, as different from British sign language as, say, Italian would be from English. They are languages in their own right, and therefore people often say, why can't you all get one sign language? Which their answer is quite generally, well, when the rest of the world decides to speak one language, we'll do the same. That's where this awful, I don't know what it is, you will do what we want you to do, whereas there are cultural profound differences. One of them, and sorry we're on radio, not television, I can show, but in England, the sign for the Son of God is only used for the Son of God, not for the son of anybody else. And it's the sign where the hand starts at the heart of the person signing. And as far as we know, it arose because the first priest to try to do it was pondering St. John's Gospel, the Son who is nearest the Father's heart, the Son who's in the bosom of the Father has made God known. So there are wonderful little gifts like that which we mustn't lose.
What can we learn from the deaf?
I learnt to receive the Gospels using my eyes, and I realised that our Lord himself was a man who used his eyes. Nearly all his stories, when you look again, are about watching and seeing. He was so observant. And whether it matters, I don't know. I happened to read when I was beginning this marvellous gift of sharing this life, I read two books, one about William Shakespeare, one about Charles Dickens, and it happened both authors made the same point: the secret of their writing was they looked and observed, Not that they listened or had imaginations. It wasn't imagination. It was their sheer power of observation. They say Shakespeare's latest plays are full of the images of the Forest of Arden, where he played as a little boy. He used his eyes, so he should do the same.
Not only do you use your eyes, but you also are using your fantasy in a certain sense. You've created a new word, which is rather difficult to spell,
yes.
Rather very difficult to sign.
Yes, yes.
So please explain it to us.
Well, I don't like the word spiritual because it suggests that somehow what really matters is up and away from flesh and time and the things we can see around us. And so my word is patri-pneumo-psychosomatic.
You can't even pronounce it,
Artie. No, patri-pneumo-psychosomatic. Psychosomatic we're used to. We're used to the idea that things that affect us emotionally are often linked with chemical imbalance. We know that the life force, the adrenaline, all that is very intimately connected with our chemistry. And we don't separate them. You try to pull them apart and you end up in trouble. But then when I add the word in pneumo, it's from the Greek word for spirit. But in this sense, I mean the ability to relate to the other as other. And one of the wonders we say is that we don't only have adrenaline. We don't only have a physical body. The marvellous thing is that all can become a means by which we relate to others. We go beyond ourselves. Somebody once said, we're all eccentric. We're all out of the centre. And that's the next stage. And I often say that the wonder of the life of the world to come, the resurrectional life of the world to come, it will wear. And today we've had with us this marvellous priest, Father Cyril Axelrod, who is blind as well as deaf. When he meets me in heaven, I'll recognise him at once. He'll have taken home the whole of his story, and the difference will be, at long last, we will both know how fully to communicate with each other. It's not that the past will be forgotten. And the other bit of the word, patri, is the Greek word for father, that the whole of this bodiliness, this adrenaline, this relating to others, comes to a wonderful climax in our relating to the Father, and therefore to everybody in the whole church. A useful word, stronger than spiritual, I think.
Well, I'm not going to even attempt to repeat Archbishop Kelly's newly coined and very complicated word. I'll sum up, though, with the words of Pope Benedict, who invites us to embrace the deaf and hearing impaired as true members of the Church's family. And he's challenging them to be active participants and real evangelizers in their communities. The Pope described today's society as suffering from a deafness of the spirit, which he says raises ever higher barriers to the voices of God and of neighbor, especially the cry for help from the least ones and those who suffer, and which encloses man in a profound and corrosive egoism. Jesus wanted to give face to a new humanity, a humanity of listening and of the word, of dialogue, of communication, of communion with God, the Pope said. And this new humanity must be without discrimination, without exclusions, so that the world will be truly for all a field of genuine fraternity. And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.